As the offering is going around for Sunday school curriculum, we'll begin our review from last week. So I won't go all the way back to February 4th. That will eat up quite a bit of our time if I just sort of cumulatively review everything that we've gone over. But last week we went over the first visions that Muhammad received. We talked about his early life, so before he was considered the founder of Islam, what that background was, his first marriage, and what that marriage was like, what his occupation was, which was a pretty successful merchant, probably middle to lower class in Mecca in the 6th century. We talked about the pagan religion of Mecca and how the Kaaba, which is currently the shrine to Islam, was actually a shrine to the polytheistic pagan practice of religion that was very prevalent in the Middle East. So it's interesting, and we discussed how the Kaaba is still used, but how Muhammad told his followers that it was actually supposed to be a shrine to Allah, and that was its true purpose. And so the repurposing of a pagan location as something that was now supposed to be used to honor the beliefs of Islam was kind of an interesting development. His first vision happened during one of his many cave meditations. We looked at the different references which talk about the angel Gabriel initially appearing to him and the experiences that we have based on just the historical sources that are available to us. So we're not really sure what the nature of those visions was, whether he actually received some sort of vision, the nature of which is really kind of up to you, or if he kind of made the whole thing up, whether he was just a well-intentioned person that didn't like the polytheistic pagan religion of the Middle East. That information is lost to history, and Muhammad, for all intents and purposes, was probably the only person who ever knew accurately what took place and what resulted in the revelations that are recorded in the Quran. Islam means submission to God, which is going to be, and this everything that I've seen supports this definition. But there's an article that I'm going to quote from a author who I believe is Muslim, who says that Islam means something else, which that'll be interesting. Okay, talked about his evolving revelations, how a lot of times if there's an issue that arose in Islam, especially an issue that would maybe cast him in a negative light, there was a revelation that would take place that would then prevent people from casting judgment on him personally, or would give the okay for whatever action he was carrying out. And we're going to continue to talk about that today with our discussion on the Hijra, which is the immigration from Mecca to the town or city of Yathrib, which you'll see there on the second subpoint at the top. Okay. There's a couple different accounts of the Hijra and what the true nature of it was, and both of those were recorded in this book that I showed you guys last week. That's sort of the basis of a lot of my study. It sort of sparks things to for me to study further, because it gives really good just general oversight. And they reference the nature of the Hijra in a couple different ways. And the first way that and maybe if you all have any sort of knowledge of Islam and this particular part of history of Islam, you would think that it was because of the persecution that was taking place in Mecca. But for the first time in my study, actually, there's record of some pagan tribes from Yathrib, which becomes known as Medina, which is the city of the prophet. That's how Medina is translated. And these tribes approach Muhammad during their Hajj rites, which is their pilgrimage, their pagan pilgrimage rites that they carry out by going to the Kaaba in Mecca. Okay, so this pilgrimage, again, this is before the Islamic, the Muslim pilgrimage to Mecca. These are, the pagan practitioners of this sort of ancient religion. And they're just going through their rites of the religion. They go to the Kaaba, and there is becoming a very influential person in Mecca, and that is Muhammad. And it seems as though he has the ability to serve as a mediator. And they notice his leadership, and of course he's gaining more and more followers within Mecca. Islam is just localized to Mecca at this point. And so these tribes go to him, and what they're telling him is that the fighting between their two pagan tribes has grown so bad, and this is a quote from the book, that they could no longer protect themselves against the three Jewish tribes with which they shared the oasis. They asked Muhammad to come, and because of his reputation as an honest man, arbitrate their quarrels. And so the next year, more pilgrims came from Yathrib and embraced Islam. And then in return for Muhammad's services as an arbiter, they agreed to give sanctuary to the Meccan Muslims. Typically, when you have conflicting reports, especially when it has to do with purpose, as to why somebody does something historically, that is always the hardest thing to discern when you're looking at any historical event. So we all know that George Washington crossed the Delaware on Christmas Eve and attacked Hessian troops. Why did he do that? Yeah, unless you have George Washington here who can explain it to us all, it's very, very hard to know what the purpose of someone's actions are, because you're really just looking inwardly to why it is that they're doing what they're doing, and really only that person can explain it to another person. That's the same issue that we have with the purpose of Muhammad starting this religion. What are his motives? Always very, very difficult, and all we can do is just make conjectures, very, very educated guesses, as close as we can to why this is taking place. But most of the time, when you have these types of conflicting reports, both are true. You say, well, how can that be? It's probably a little bit of both. What is motivating Muhammad to leave Mecca? Probably that his religion is not becoming as established as he'd like, and he is receiving some persecution. Okay. Does that mean that Muhammad is being forced out of Mecca at this period of time? It seems as though that is not the case, because these tribes do in fact invite him to become an arbiter for their problems with these other Jewish tribes. Okay. So it's probably both things that are happening. Muhammad is contemplating these requests. He is essentially accepting an invitation to become a political leader in Yathrib, which is a substantial evolution for Islam, as you're going to see, because the revelations begin to have to do with political beliefs. And today, what very often do you see happens in areas that have a very high Muslim population? Is it like the United States, where Christianity is not the national religion of the United States? No, it's in fact quite the opposite. If you have a concentration of Muslims, very often that directly bleeds into what type of legislation is being passed in whatever government is over that area. And Iran is a great example of that. And many of the other Middle Eastern countries where you have a large concentration of Muslims, the government is also Islamic, and they are passing laws that are based on the Hadith or other teachings of Islam. And so that is probably rooted in this initial emigration to Medina. Muhammad's political power in the town is not immediately realized. Okay? He finds that he kind of goes there, according to a lot of accounts, it seems as though he believes that this is going to go extremely well. Okay? Three Jewish tribes inhabit this oasis with some other tribes that are pagan. It's mostly an agricultural area. And if he is viewing himself as a continuation of the prophecy of both Judaism and Christianity, Muhammad certainly sees this as an opportunity to reach Jewish tribes and for them to accept him as the next prophet in the line of all of their other prophets. Because the Quran teaches all of those things and teaches that Jewish prophets are also Islamic prophets. So this is a great opportunity. And once he gets there, though, Jews are not very willing to accept him as a prophet. And so that's something else that we'll touch on in the next slide. We do have Islam becoming this political power, okay, which it will continue to be to its present time. Okay. So it's very interesting that basically throughout all of Islam's history, its potency as a political tool has been a very practical application of the religion. And it's very similar to the political power that was wielded by the Roman Catholic Church during this time and for the Middle Ages, really leading up to sort of self-governing principles of democracy. And as those take root, then you have more and more independence from centralized political powers like the Pope and the Roman Catholic Church. The Sunnah and Hadith, it's important to, at this time, reference these because they're different than the Quran. Right? And don't judge me. I took these definitions from Wikipedia. I always told my students, like, if you're doing a research paper, do not cite Wikipedia. Use Wikipedia to get your citations. So Wikipedia uses sources for its articles. It's a secondary source of a secondary source. So is it highly reliable? Yeah, it kind of is, actually. if you rely on it for like absolute truth on a certain subject, then no, it's really not that great at that. But today's Wikipedia is actually policed pretty well. So like I said, please do not judge my research ability by the fact that I have it quoted here. So it's the Sunnah and the Hadith are actually similar to the traditional teachings, the rabbinic teachings that the Jews adopt as part of the practice of their religion. So you have the Torah and, of course, the sacred scripture of Judaism that is held in very high regard. But the teachings and the traditions that are based on that scripture, that is sort of the practical way in which Judaism is practiced, not to sound too redundant. The Sunnah and Hadith are pretty much the exact same in the sense that they are the teachings of Muhammad that are not necessarily divine revelations. Okay? So how do you live out the Quran? Because we've already covered how complicated of a book it is and how there's clear teachings and unclear teachings. How do you live as a Muslim? And it's a big question, especially if you're only practicing a religion that's been around for like a decade, which at this point is what's happening. These records are the traditions and practices of Muhammad. He is basically setting himself up as the model Muslim so that everyone else can live like he lives. And then he and some other Islamic teachers are recording these traditions and the oral teachings of Muhammad, and they kind of go hand in hand with the Quran. Okay, and that is being established during their time, during the Muslims' time in Medina. So what are some of the problems here? Muhammad is not immediately able to fix the societal issues. So you'll recall we have these two pagan tribes, and they ask Muhammad, please come arbitrate these issues that we're having with these three Jewish tribes, and he's going to show up, and he is the prophet, the next prophet, the final prophet for the Jews, as well as the Christians, the people of the book, and the Muslims, right? So they're going to accept him as the prophet, and all of these issues are going to be fixed, except that's not really how it happened. The Jews are looking through the Quran and the teachings of Muhammad, and they're like, there's a ton of discrepancy here, which is probably apparent because, as I said 2 weeks ago, Muhammad doesn't really know Judaism and Christianity very well. He just knows it like in a very surface way, and the way that he applies it is very often incorrect. And so that's why you're going to get a lot of contradictions in the Quran and incorrect assumptions about what Jews and Christians believe. The Jews are locating these in his teachings, and you're not a prophet. In fact, how do you think the Jews are going to accept Muhammad claiming that he's the next prophet? or the final prophet? So it's essentially the same response that a lot of Jews had with Jesus, which is this blasphemy that you think that you're receiving visions that contradict the teachings of the Torah and that you would associate yourself with our prophets of Abraham and Moses and all of these teachers that the Jews follow. And so it's not just that they're like, well, you know, we don't really believe you. It's that they're opposing him now. Right? And that is certainly not, I don't know if it's not what he expected, because again, I don't have the sources to back that claim up, but it's certainly not what he was there to achieve. Okay? And this is also a very big turning point in the revelations in the Quran. Because what you see prior to the Hijra is that the Muslims are supposed to treat the people of the book, which often refer to Jews and Christians, how? With respect, accepting. There's even parts of the Quran where Muhammad says to Christians, compare, you know, judge the revelations in the Quran with your religion, and you'll find that they're right. You know, he's basically saying, I'm an open book. Okay? And when they're not going to accept him and his teachings based on the contradictions, then how is he going to respond? Another problem that occurs in Medina is that if it's an agricultural oasis there in Saudi Arabia, north of Mecca, that is not the type of lifestyle that these immigrants from Mecca are used to living. These are merchants, much like Muhammad himself, so they're not really good at farming. How are they going to be able to support themselves if they do not have the support of the Jewish tribes, which it turns out actually control most of the agricultural land in and around Medina? How are they going to sustain themselves? Okay, because they made this entire trip, you know, hundreds of miles north, and now they have no way to not just make money, but they don't really have a way to support this population. So, now we get to an interesting teaching that seems to come about around this time, which is the teaching on jihad, fighting, and killing. Okay, I'm trying to think what order I want to do this in. Let's go to the next slide. Okay, so this is kind of you could call it like a sidebar. So as I'm going through the history of the foundation of Islam, this is a lesson on I don't know if you could say it's a core teaching, but certainly a major topic in the Quran, which is the treatment of violence. So here is the article that I was referencing before that makes the claim of its title, which is that Islam is a religion of peace. How many of you have heard that expression before? Okay, so it's very prevalent, it's pretty common by those who either are apologists for Muslims or by Muslims themselves, that they would say Islam is in fact a religion of peace. And this argument came about especially after what took place on 9/11, because what was the overwhelming feeling in America about Islam after those terrorist attacks? That it was a religion of warfare, and that it was because these attacks were carried out based on their religious beliefs that all Muslims were sort of up for questioning. Okay, and then there was a big argument about discrimination against Muslims, and a vast majority, and this is a quote that they use in the article, a vast majority of these Muslims are peaceful. Okay. So I'm just going to go ahead and read what's there on the screen. Those who claim Islam is an inherently violent religion ignore the overwhelming majority of adherents to the faith. There are more than 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide who live peacefully. They would also ignore that using religion as justification for violence is nothing new. There are countless examples of members of other religions invoking faith as they perpetrate violence. Buddhist nationalist movements in Sri Lanka, which my uncle Terry would be familiar with, and Myanmar, instigating violent campaigns against Muslims, for instance, which those actually did take place. Most people are able to critically analyze these movements and not lay the blame on Buddhism or Christianity. So, using your discerning, put on your historian caps here. What is the issue? What are some issues? There's two main issues with her argument here. What's one of those? I'm not asking you to read my mind because there might be more than two, but there's two that I'm thinking of and I want to get your take. Why would you disagree with what Omar, and that's a last name, what she is saying here, I believe it's a woman, what she is saying with in this article? Yes.
In the Holy Land, they were actually trying to rid the Muslim population, but in doing that, they did not discriminate between the Jewish people. The Christians that were there were also killed, and so were the people of Islam.
Yeah, and the Crusades, that's a very common... I'm actually surprised that she didn't bring up the Crusades, because that's usually what people go to. Well, the Crusades, you know, there's a bunch of Christian knights that go over to the Middle East and try to reclaim Jerusalem, and do they commit atrocities? Absolutely, we have record of it. Okay, so what makes Christianity any, at that point, what makes Christianity any better than Islam? Yes, Mr. Ortel?
In this case, are they trying to project on the Muslims or Christians for that matter, the Buddhists?
Yeah, it almost reads like a red herring argument, where the argument in this case that people are making is not, we're not talking about Buddhism and Christianity. We're talking about Islam. So by you citing other instances of religious violence, like anybody can do that. I can cite all kinds of instances of violence all over the world for a variety of reasons. What does that have to do with Islamic violence? Right, which I think is the point that you're making. Yeah. Okay, so here's kind of the issue that I had, first of all. And I read the entire article, so you guys can take my word for it. At no point does she cite a single surah from the Quran.
A single what?
Surah, which is a chapter of the Quran. So not even a single verse of the Quran is cited in her argument that Islam is a religion of peace. Massive red flag for me. Because what is your holy scripture if you're Muslim? It's the Quran. So wouldn't the strongest argument that your religion is a religion of peace be your own sacred scripture and revelations of your prophet? How does that not make it into any of your arguments that it's a religion of peace? We're going to find out why. Okay. The other issue with this argument is that the fact that Muslims live peacefully doesn't, like, it's a very easy argument for me to refute, because couldn't I just say that those Muslims living peacefully are not following the teachings of the Quran? Doesn't necessarily mean that Islam is a religion of peace, because I'm not making the argument that 1.5 billion Muslims are terrorists. I'm making an argument that the foundations of your religion, in fact, teach that violence and killing is okay. So whether or not those people follow those teachings is really a non-factor. Okay? The second issue that's here is a same-as argument, which is always, always dangerous. Okay? This instance is the same as this. Right? So that should always, you know, in discussions and, you know, whether or not you're witnessing to somebody who's kind of militant about, you know, their own personal beliefs and are not accepting of the gospel, whenever there's a yeah but argument, that's a problem. Because nobody, and I don't want to make too general of a statement, but if she was debating me and used this example, I would say I will be the first person to also say that those things are wrong. But much like Mr. Ortel said, we're not talking about these examples. And if you want to bring up these examples, then for every example of a Christian nationalist movement or a Buddhist nationalist movement, I can give you 10 to 15 examples of terrorist attacks that take place more recently than these. Right? So your argument that other things happen that are based on religious violence is really not an argument in the affirmative, because you're still not saying that Islam is a religion of peace. She openly admits that there's countless examples of other religions. So she's not saying that Islam is a religion of peace. She's saying it actually, in her argument, she's admitting that it is maybe not a religion of peace. So she's admitting that those things actually happen, that terrorist attacks actually happen, and that violence has been associated with Islam, but it's also associated with other religions. Well, does that make it okay? Like, aren't we all on the same page that we don't want any religious violence? So once again, we're not talking about the Buddhists or the Christians in Myanmar. We're talking about Islam, okay? So her argument in this article is, I think, a fairly accurate reflection, and I'm sure some other imams could do a much better job of arguing her cause than she did. But I would, you know, there's a lot of holes in this argument for why Islam is a religion of peace. Mr. Pierce, did you have a comment? And in my mind, if the argument suddenly turns to, but what about God commanding Israel to go into Canaan and eliminate all those tribes, it's still a false equivalency argument. Because no two things historically are the exact same. Right? So if you're trying to say that that's the same as Islamic teachings about violence, then I'm going to have a pretty easy time dismantling that argument that you're standing on. You're going to have to, ultimately, if the question is whether or not Islam is a religion of peace, then the person who's arguing in the negative is going to have to make an argument that Islam is a religion of peace, not point out where other religions are religions of violence. Correct? Because now we're just making the argument, well, all of the religions are violent. Okay, so you have won my argument for me that Islam is in fact a religion of violence, because you've admitted that all religions are violent, correct? So it's not a good argument, okay? And that's why I say again, someone else that is a little bit better at making arguments and is aware of issues that logical fallacies in arguments that would argue for Islam could do a much better job here and would probably, you know, give me and a lot of other, like Dr. James White, they'd give them more of a run for their money, because they'd understand that that's not a good position to hold. Yes. I think all you have to do is look at the nature of the retaliation by Israel and the nature of the attack. Are there record of Israeli soldiers going door to door killing women and children? No, they in fact go to a, probably from the position of military strategy, to a fault, go out of their way to make sure civilians clear out of areas before they bomb them. And will, in fact, not target known terrorist meeting places and armories if the death toll of civilians is going to be too great. Okay? So it's very interesting, especially in light of that attack, how many people were so hesitant and were so careful in their language that, well, again, they use the yeah, but argument. Yeah, but Israel also attacks people in Jordan and people in Palestine. Yeah, but a false equivalency argument is still false. Okay, we're arguing that the October 7th attack was atrocious and terrible. So can we at least agree on that? And that's where you can't get them to admit that, because they keep using this, oh yeah, but this also is, this is an event and this is an event, and what do you say for this? And you're not answering the question that we're talking about. Okay? So you have to make sure that ultimately you're arguing about one point instead of multiple points. Okay? And that's where nobody knows how to debate anymore. So hopefully that's just kind of a side thing that I can teach you all how to debate. We'll do Lincoln Douglas style, right? Okay, so here is a quote, and I'm actually going to take the time to read this whole thing because I think it's that good, and part of it is up on the screen there. This is by Ayman S. Ibrahim, and this the topic of this article is fighting and killing in the Quran, and this can be found in the Quran with Christian Commentary, which is written by Gordon D. Nickel. Okay, so see there, Ibrahim is quoted in this book here. So this is a translation of the Quran, which is a pretty common English translation by A.J. Droege. And in it, this, from a Christian perspective, and again, I'm not saying that Gordon D. Nickel is going to be as, you know, held up as a model Christian or as doctrinally sound as we all are. I don't know. I read the foreword, and it seems like he is born again, but again, I don't know. This is very, very well done, and I'm actually going to give you the references, all of the references that Ibrahim gives for the Quran. So this is the beginning here. Fighting is a central theme in the Quran. The verb kill occurs in 77 verses in various forms, fight in 39, and the participle fighting in 10. In Arabic, the commands to fight and to kill, as well as the noun for battles, all have the same root letters, QTL. While the Quran is not a military guide, it repeatedly directs the reader to engage in fighting and killing for Allah's cause. For the early hearers of the Quran who used to raid each other, incursions and expeditions became wars for Allah. Fighting is now prescribed by Allah as duty for the believers, and this can be found in Surah 2, verse 216, Surah 4, verse 77, and Surah 47, verse 20. Allah instructs the Prophet, who is Muhammad, the Quran's recipient, to urge and exhort the believers to fight, in Surah 865. Only weak believers do not pursue fighting, Surah 3, 167. It is for Allah's cause, 244, and it is divinely ordained, in 4, verse 77, and 47, verse 20. Allah loves those fighting in his cause, 61 verse 4, and he is sufficient for them, 33 verse 25. Faithful believers pursue fighting in Allah's path, 244 to 246, 3, 13, 146, 195, 4 verse 84, 9 verse 111, 73 verse 20. While believers fight for the devil, which is talked about in Surah 4, in their fighting, believers sell the present life for the hereafter, 4 verse 74. They will be rewarded with gardens flowing with rivers, which is in Surah 3. Fighting is thus sanctioned by Allah, but the question remains, whom should the believers fight? The Quran calls for fighting several groups. The polytheist, or associators, which is in 936, the infidels in 839, 912, and 9123, the people who received the scripture, which is a reference to who? Christians and Jews, presumably, which is in 929 through 30, and the unjust Quranic believers. So this would be like apostates. The Quran despises those who remain at home instead of fighting, and this is in Surah 3, 5, 9, and 48. It instructs both defensive and offensive fighting, and honestly, the quotations here are too long to list, and promises divine support and victory in Surah 3 and 48. While fighting does not necessarily mean killing, the Quran often uses the command to kill explicitly in relation to fighting. In fighting, the believers are to kill infidels in Surah 4 and strike their necks in Surah 47. While one is supposed to kill only for justifiable reasons, and there's a lot of references there, the Quran refers to polytheism as a greater evil than killing, which is in Surah 2, and thus instructs killing polytheists wherever they are caught. It also commands the believers to kill the people of the book, Christians and Jews typically is the reference, or sometimes Christians only, in Surah 33, hypocrites also in 33, and those who do not want peace, Surah 4. The Quran's believers are not allowed to kill their fellow believers except mistakenly or unintentionally. Like many prophets and messengers who are killed by unbelievers, the believers, when killed in battle, are martyrs for Allah's cause. The Quran is not primarily about warfare, but the reader cannot avoid a loud call for war throughout. The commands kill and fight, as well as the noun fighting, signify aspects, reasons, and targets of divinely prescribed warfare. Quranic fighting is distinct, as Allah sanctions it and identifies specifically whom are to be fought by the believers. While a few verses mandate fighting and killing only in self-defense, the vast majority of warfare references are read as an open call, universal and timeless. And this is where my quote begins on the screen. Trying to find context for many Quranic passages, including those with imperatives to fight, kill and fight, can be very difficult. The reader cannot know clearly whether a command is time-bound and limited or timeless and universal. This is one reason why Muslims today can be confused as to whether the commands are applicable in our day or are merely descriptive of past events. The challenge for Muslims is that the earliest commentaries on the Quran by renowned Muslim scholars take these commands as prescriptive and mandatory. It thus becomes the decision of the reader as to which commands to follow, a significant decision with huge implications. So going back to this quote, that there are more than 1.5 billion Muslims worldwide who are living peacefully, again, not an argument in favor when you look at the fact that the earliest commentaries on the Quran are that the commands are prescriptive and mandatory, and basically it's just left up to the reader whether you follow them or not. Okay? And this, once again, goes back to the teachings of the Quran by this clear teaching and unclear teaching category. Is it obvious that you're supposed to kill the unbelievers? Or is it not very obvious? And most Muslims would say that is not a clear teaching. Okay? And because there are times in the Quran that also call for peace and civility, that those are the commands that are going to take preeminence over the commands to kill unbelievers. But you can see how this is a very dangerous stance to take, because someone who's reading the Quran critically, like Ibrahim obviously has, with all of these citations about fighting and killing directed at people who are unbelievers, you're basically just choosing to emphasize the peaceful passages of the Quran over the violent passages, as opposed to saying that those passages don't exist. And that is why there are no references to the Quran in this article, because you cannot make the argument that the Quran does not command fighting and killing of those who are unbelievers. Because, I mean, do you want me to go through all these references again? It obviously does. In all of these places it does. Okay. So here's an example of it. Quran 22, verse 39. To those against whom war is made, permission is given to those who fight because they are wronged, and surely God is able to help them. Permission is given to the fighters on behalf of Islam because they are wronged. Okay, so now you need a cause. You're wronged. And you can now wage war, and God, or Allah, is able to help them. Okay? Quran, Surah 2. They will question you about the holy month and fighting in it. Say, fighting in it is wrong, but to bar from God's way and disbelief in Him and the sacred Kaaba and to expel its people from it, that is more wicked in God's sight, and persecution is more wicked than killing. Okay, that word that came before fighting, when I said say, that would be read as a command from the angel Gabriel to the prophet. So basically, he's commanding the prophet to say what is followed, and that is fighting in it is wrong, but to bar from God's way and disbelief of Him, that's worse. Okay. So what is this fighting in the holy month? And what is, we talked about the sacred Kaaba. What does it mean to expel the Kaaba's people from it? The Kaaba is located in what city? Mecca. And who are, according to Muslims, the people of the Kaaba, true people? Muslims. So if they're expelled, okay, that is more wicked than killing. Okay? So now let's talk about this holy month, because it directly correlates to what's taking place after the Hijra, after the Hijra. Because going back, okay, we have these Muslims are now finding it difficult to be successful merchants, to sustain themselves in Medina. Things are not going politically as Muhammad hoped. And now what is going to be the solution to these problems? The solution is going to be to begin raiding caravans on their way to Mecca and using the loot from those caravans to now support and enrich Muhammad and his followers and the Islamic government that has now been established in Medina. Okay. Now, the argument is going to be made that these, and this is what Muslims would say, that the raids that took place, once again, they won't say that they didn't take place, they'll say that they were defensive. Okay, so if we're Americans and we would all say that if you are openly attacked by someone who is being aggressive towards you and you've committed no wrong, that you have the right to self-defense, correct? And so historically speaking, when wars happen, usually there's an aggressor and there's a person who is on the defensive. And we usually support the person who is taking the position as defending themselves because they're not openly seeking war. Now, that doesn't say that preemptive strikes are a bad idea or anything like that, but generally speaking, aggression is bad and defending yourself is good. So is this an argument that can be made? Because if it can be made that the Muslims in Medina were just defending themselves by raiding these caravans, and this was just part of the war that they were experiencing with the Meccans, then we would have a completely different argument. My question, as someone who has, you know, studied various battles and wars throughout history, is what would prompt those in Mecca to aggressively and offensively attack the Muslims that are living in Medina? Okay, the Meccans did not like Muhammad and the Muslims. Okay, and part of that reason that they leave to Medina is because of that persecution. If the Meccans get exactly what they want by Muhammad leaving, what is then prompting them to go pick a fight with him up in Medina? It seems a lot more historically accurate that what prompted the Meccans to send armies to Medina to fight the Muslims is that the Muslims were attacking Meccan caravans. Because otherwise, there really is no, unless they just really hated the Muslims, which I suppose is an argument that you could try to make, why in the world would they go aggressively, you know, hundreds of miles north through the Saudi Arabian desert? They're just going to try to hunt this guy down and kill him for just, for what reason? Because they didn't want to kill him before, right? Because he lived in Mecca, they would have had every opportunity to kill and murder his followers when they lived there. So why now that he's established at Medina? Is it because he's starting to wield more political power and they're afraid of him and so they go attack him? Maybe. Or is their trade being disrupted because the Muslims are attacking their caravans? And again, you have to kind of play a game of what's more likely at this point, right? And it seems that it's very going to be a very difficult argument for a Muslim to make that this was in fact a defensive attack on these caravans. It seems, even based on the teachings in the Quran, that, you know, it doesn't have to be defensive. Okay? They're attacking these caravans during the holy month of this pagan religion. So during a holy month where there's no fighting, and generally speaking, those in the Middle East would agree that this was a time of peace, and there are pilgrims that are on their way to Mecca, and don't attack their caravans and don't attack anybody because, you know, they're just going there for a peaceful practice of their rites, R-I-T-E-S, of their religion. But the Muslims don't respect the holy month, and they attack them anyway. Now, let me ask you, when do a lot of the attacks against the Jewish state happen? What day of the week? Saturday, which is the Sabbath. Have the Israelis ever waged a war during the month of Ramadan? And I actually can't answer that question because I haven't looked into it enough. What would be the global response of Israel beginning a vast military campaign against a Muslim state in the month of Ramadan? You can't attack a Muslim during the holy month. They're all fasting. They're at their weakest. When do Muslims attack people? Why were those different areas on October 7th not as well manned, those different points along the border? Because it was a Sabbath. You don't think the Muslims knew that? But they're justified. They're justified. They will question you about fighting the holy month and fighting in it, but say fighting in it is wrong. But to bar from God's way and disbelief in him, that is more wicked in God's sight. And persecution of Muslims, that those are my words, is more wicked than killing. And so there are justifications for these terrorist attacks, and there are justifications that can be found directly in the revelations of the prophet. Okay, I have time for like maybe one question. So sorry, there's a lot of content in that, and that's probably the longest I've talked straight in a long time. Yes? Yeah, I would say there's some similarities there. Because as a Christian, you couldn't say that every single teaching in the Bible is truly absolute, and that everyone, because, you know, people, the Bible even allows for people to have different convictions, and that Christians' lifestyle may not immediately match up with the person sitting next to them. And we're all a perfect example of that, because none of us have identical lives. We don't all have our devotions at the same time of the day. You know, we don't all do the exact same things in our, you know, we all have different spiritual gifts and so forth. But the implications of the Bible's teachings regarding those are way less extreme than the implications of saying the scripture, the Quran's teachings on killing are up for interpretation. Because like the end of the quote said, that has extremely important implications. Okay, so the reader can go either way here. So for somebody who has studied the Quran to say it's kind of, you know, maybe either or, I would say there's no teaching in the Bible about like the just murdering somebody because they're an unbeliever, because that's up for interpretation. There's really nowhere you can find that's up for interpretation. So I think we will have to cover the topic that Mr. Pierce brought up about the commands for the Israelites to go into Canaan and what happened there, because there's a lot of good Christian commentary on that, and the arguments that people use about how Christianity is a violent religion and is essentially just as guilty of religious violence as any other religion. Certainly that's not the case, but we also can't make an argument that those things have never happened, especially if you move on past the canon of Scripture and the end of the Revelation with the book of Revelation, that Christianity has never been militant and violent, because, of course, as the most common argument goes, the Crusades did take place. So we're going to have to end there so that I can be on time. And then if